the Mom Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. May Martinez. A settlement from a gender and race discrimination lawsuit at the LA Times could reshape how the newspaper covers stories in a city as diverse as LA and also who winds up writing them. Plus, how a potential coronavirus vaccine could not only save lives but also rescue struggling movie theater chains all over the United States. That and more is all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Coming up.
We fought segregation fighting over there, and we fought segregation when we got back home over here.
This Veterans Day, we'll hear from 95-year-old Luther Hendricks, who, as a soldier, battled racism and prejudice on two continents. That's just ahead. But we start with the failure of Prop 15. It was an attempt to nibble away at Prop 13, that's the 42-year-old cap on property taxes, and had it passed, it would have imposed higher taxes on commercial properties. But though the yeses and the noes were close, last night it was determined that it did not have enough votes to pass. Here to discuss the significance of this, we have with us Zach Corser. He's a visiting assistant professor of government at Claremont McKenna College and co-director of the Policy Lab. Now, Zach, let's break down the vote, because my understanding is that while LA County voters were in favor, the rest of Southern California was not so much in favor. So who was behind Prop 15 and who wasn't across the state?
Well, looking at the state as a whole, really the only place that it was passing either by a comfortable or large margin were select Bay Area counties. But by and large, it was a fairly polarizing vote. I mean, it looks misleading maybe to say that, you know, it's down 3.6% in the state overall. Very polarized vote. I mean, certainly places like San Diego, Orange County, which are always going to be skeptical about any kind of tax measures. You know, it lost big there, you know, lost over 20 points in Orange County. But places like Sacramento, you know, was losing by almost 8 points there as well. So, you know, it's a polarizing vote. And I think it's just sort of saying, you know, like, you know, everyone realizes, you know, Prop 13 is still here to stay, and that voters still recognize its significance. They don't want to see it changing.
And we're going to get into Prop 13 coming up in just a bit on how that might have factored into voters' decision. But ultimately, why do you think it failed? I mean, how big of a factor do you think the pandemic was in the voters' minds when they cast their ballots on 15?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, both sides were fairly evenly matched in terms of fundraising. They both raised about $60 million on both sides. So it wasn't as lopsided as, say, Prop 22. I think I've seen both sides on this. I think there's a case to be made for both. I think on one side, there's a notion that during a pandemic, you don't want to do anything to further burden small business. And that was certainly an argument that was made by the opposition side. But at the same time, there's an argument on the other side that I think was also very important. And that is, we need to do something about funding for schools and localities. And this, you know, they were trying to link the idea of changing this tax regime to supporting schools. I mean, that was the big idea. And I, you know, in terms of which side won out, you know, again, I think it was close, but by and large, you know, outside of LA County and some Bay Area cities, most of California said no thanks.
Close, what, by 3.6%. That's what Prop 15 lost by. What do you make of how tight it was?
Well, I think, you know, it's encouraging for the side that put Prop 15 on the ballot. I think, you know, while we can still say that, you know, Californians are still very leery of any alterations to Prop 13 and the caps we've had on property taxes for since the late 70s. It's close enough, I think, to say that this is worth another go. I mean, I would not be surprised after, you know, post-pandemic in 2022 or 2024 that we're not going to see another attempt at this. You know, maybe the pitch will be slightly different. Maybe they'll come up with a modified proposal, but I see no reason why the side that got this on the ballot wouldn't see this as a signal that, you know, it's close, but there's no reason why it couldn't get closer.
Well, let's get to Prop 13, because that's the 1978, four-decade-old cap on property taxes. How much of a factor is it that Prop 13 is just seemingly so entrenched in our lives here in California, Zach? I mean, people just don't want to see it go away. And there are some that consider any attempt at all, some like Prop 13, to be an attempt to completely eliminate Prop 13 with one fell swoop.
Well, you know, there's a little bit of evidence here to show that it actually was on voters' minds that if we start to alter the idea of split roll, I mean, if we take into consideration the idea of split roll, that we're going to start with commercial properties and essentially, you know, repeal Prop 13 for them or modify it significantly, that there's some kind of slippery slope that you're opening up. Berkeley's Institute of Government, Governmental Studies did a poll in October of likely voters, and 56% of them said that they thought this was a first step to making similar changes to the way residential properties are taxed in the future. And at that time, 9% were undecided, and it seems like the undecideds pretty much decided that, yeah, that was the case. So, I mean, it's a significant worry and concern. And I think voters were not convinced that this was just for schools or this was just about commercial properties. I think they were really concerned that we might get back into a situation where California's property taxes were out of control.
Zach, I've seen and read quote after quote from legislators, former lawmakers in California that have said that whether it's incremental or, you know, with one big punch, the goal is to eliminate Prop 13. Do you think that that also is in the voters' minds, though, the ones that really like Prop 13 and want to keep it around, that, yeah, like as you said, that any attempt would be just one way to kind of nibble at Prop 13 by just a little bit?
Yeah, you know, right. You know, it's sort of, you know, how do you eat a whale one bite at a time? I mean, there's been small modifications to Prop 13 over the years. I think I was reading earlier today that, you know, there's been 20 tweaks here and there to it over time. But I think the core principle here is that, you know, both sides of the aisle in terms of talking about voters now, you know, obviously California is a very Democratic state. Obviously, Joe Biden, you know, had no trouble running up the popular vote with his big advantage here in California. But this is something that transcends party lines. You know, if you think about who Californians are and sort of, you know, what they depend on, it's talking about single family homeowners, talking about people who care, you know, about maintaining an acceptable and low level of taxation on their property. And that's something that transcends partisanship in California. It's sort of like something very particular, but very strong about the California electorate. They want to hold on to this.
We're talking to Zach Courser. He's a visiting assistant professor of government at Claremont McKenna College and co-director of the Policy Lab. All right. Now, the other big election news yesterday, Zach, was that Harley Ruta conceded to Michelle Steele in the 48th district. Was that a surprise or did you see this one coming?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think there's a long conversation to be had here, maybe about polling. You know,
we've had it, Zach, so many times about polling. This, yeah, it's been a big topic.
So we'll just stipulate that, right? And we'll say that people were expecting a blue wave, like they saw in 2018, that, you know, somehow Biden was going to pull in Congress with him, that we're going to see some big changes in the Senate, like we did in 1980, where you saw a lot of senior senators going down with a popular incoming Democratic president. That just didn't happen. The numbers are down in the House, actually. And it looks like, you know, we're coming down to Georgia to decide the majority in the Senate right now. So in this, you know, non-wave election for Congress, it does look like, you know, what happened in 2018 maybe isn't as secure or as obvious it will continue as we thought it was. I mean, you look at Orange County and all the seats that changed over in 2018, I think there was an expectation that, oh, well, the switch has been flipped. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't. The wave is receding. I mean, we see freshman Democrats falling before GOP challengers, despite the fact that Trump had a very weak result here. And let's talk about Steele and Ruta. It's interesting to me, you know, Steele, I mean, Ruta's a former Republican. He's a businessman. He's kind of ready-made to be a kind of moderate Democrat who would appeal to this district potentially. Michelle Steele, you know, is very much a conservative. I don't think she shies away from it at all. You know, her husband's former chair of the state party, you know, and you look at the results, and Steele actually outperformed Trump in the district. She got about 8,000 more votes than Trump did. And Ruta ran just behind Biden by about 6 points. Biden ended up carrying the district by 1.7 points, but it's sort of like, it's a tale for our time where we're having a hard time basically conflating the idea of a vote for Joe Biden with somehow a vote for a Democratic Congress. people split their tickets on the margins where it really mattered. And so there's races around California and around the country where we thought, oh, of course, these are going to be Democratic from here on out. And it's just not the case.
And Ruta, for his part, has indicated, Zach, that he's going to do a tail of the tape. In other words, compare his 2 years and then compare Michelle Steele's 2 years and then run again in 2 years and run on that. He feels that his track record will be stronger than her track record. But, I mean, this is where we are right now, especially in Orange County, where from cycle to cycle, we don't know what Orange County is going to turn out like.
Yeah, well, it's true. And it's competitive. And, you know, one of the things that's frustrating, I think, from a public policy standpoint about this is all the energies that we would like, political energies that we would like to be seen in Congress focusing on things like healthcare reform or working on the deficit or all the many sort of policy topics that really deserve our attention. Instead, that energy is going to be put on 2022 and the midterm election. You know, we've already got Ruta saying, I'm going to see you again. You know, we'll see each other in 2 years. It makes one worried about what the next 2 years are going to look like from a policy perspective between the White House and Congress. I think we're probably going to see more of the same, which is each side sort of getting into their bunkers and hunkering down and waiting for the next election.
And each side constantly in election mode, right? Because, I mean, there's governing mode and then there's election mode. And if the majority of the time is spent in election mode, not much governing gets done.
That's right. You're spending all your time fundraising. You're spending all your time preparing for the next campaign. You're not focused on legislation. In fact, if anything, legislation is not profitable. It sort of, you know, makes people take sides when you take a vote. And so it's more profitable to go on Fox News or CNN or on the internet and sort of talk rather than doing public policy.
Zach Corser is an assistant professor of government at Claremont McKenna College and co-director of the Policy Lab. Zach, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jay.
All right, moving on. In honor of Veterans Day, we'll hear from 95-year-old World War II veteran who battled forces both in the Pacific Theater and back home in America. KPCC's Robert Garova has a story.
On December 7th, 1941, Japan, like its infamous Axis partners, struck first and declared war afterwards.
Luther Hendricks was just a teenager when the attack on Pearl Harbor happened. He says he was determined to fight, to save his country from the enemy.
Once President Roosevelt declared war, I went down the next day to join up. I was told that they didn't take colors in the Marines.
But as the war effort ramped up, the armed services began following an order from President Franklin D. Roosevelt to open all branches of the U.S. Armed Forces to African Americans. Hundreds of black enlistees were accepted into the Marine Corps, though they were segregated from white troops.
We weren't allowed to go and train with the white Marines, which was just across the street from us at Camp Lejeune. We weren't allowed to go over there unless we had a white officer to go with us.
White enlistees were trained at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. Black men went through grueling training at nearby Montford Point. There, servicemen like Hendricks endured substandard conditions and racism.
We was always talked of as boy, colored people, you people, never man or a person, you know.
But Hendricks says he and his fellow Marines were not deterred.
America is the only country I know of, and I was proud of it. The segregation part was hard, but I paid it no mind, because back in them days, everybody was gung-ho to defeat the enemy and come on back and get to your regular life.
Between 1942 and 1949, 20,000 black Marines trained at Montford Point. The Montford Point Marines, as they're known, would go on to be celebrated in military history. Like the famed Tuskegee Airmen, they too were trailblazers. After training, Hendricks saw a long tour in the Pacific.
I was in Guam, Saipan, Iwo Jima, Okinawa.
But Hendricks says while he was happy to return home after the war, there was still work to be done when he got back.
We fought segregation fighting over there, and we fought segregation when we got back home over here.
Hendricks says he would have liked to continue his military career when he returned from war, but was met with closed doors yet again. Hendricks would go on to work as an electrician's assistant and has lived in the Bay Area town of Vallejo ever since coming back from war. More than six decades later, Hendricks and his fellow Montford Point Marines were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. Here's California Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi speaking at the ceremony in 2012.
The time of these Marines in an age of inequality Breaking the color barrier in the Marine Corps took nothing less than perseverance, patriotism, and courage of extraordinary proportions.
That was a great day. I just can't say enough about that.
For his part, Hendricks says he was never expecting to be awarded one of the nation's highest honors, especially since he and his fellow black Marines were treated unequally by the service.
We've come a long ways, and I have people in service now, like when I went back to Washington, come up and said, thank you for paving the way, because I wouldn't be where I am without you. And that makes you feel good. You feel like it was all worth it. But as a country, we still got a ways to go. We see changes coming now, but it's slow.
These days, Hendricks says he enjoys traveling as much as possible, seeing states across the U.S., before the pandemic anyway. And he's proud of his grandkids, great-grandkids, and great-great-grandkids. This Veterans Day, Hendricks says he'd like Americans to remember the determination of the Montford Point Marines and others during World War II. They deserve to be honored, he says. I'm Robert Garova.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. All right, a settlement from a gender and race discrimination lawsuit at the Los Angeles Times could reshape how the newspaper covers stories in a city that is diverse as Los Angeles. But one other part to it, it could also really shape who winds up writing those stories about diverse LA. We'll get into that and more when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Yesterday, the Los Angeles Times and its former owner, Tribune Publishing, agreed to pay $3 million to resolve a class action lawsuit brought by the paper's own journalists. The plaintiffs allege that gender, race, and ethnic discrimination resulted in management paying women and people of color less than their white male counterparts. The judge in the case gave preliminary approval to the proposed settlement late last month, which would make 240 current and former employees eligible for back pay. Joining us now are two LA Times reporters, Meg James, a media reporter covering the story, and Bettina Boxall is a Metro reporter and lead plaintiff in the case. Boxall started at the paper in 1987.
The paper had a culture, basically, if you don't talk about salaries, you don't ask other people about salaries. And there was a, you know, suspicion on the part of women that they were being paid less than men, and there were some anonymous surveys that were conducted by newsroom employees over the years, and partial results were posted on a bulletin board, and I could see that I was paid less, but didn't know for sure because there was no union, there were no contract minimums, there was no way of exactly knowing, you know, what people were being paid. And over the years, I various times brought up that I thought I was being underpaid and asked for more of a raise and never really got anywhere. And then in 2009, when I won a Pulitzer with a colleague of mine, Julie Cart, we got no raises, you know, no bonuses. And then in 2016, this was when the paper was still owned by Tribune, there had been no newsroom-wide raises for quite some time, but there was finally going to be a 2.5% raise. And I was called in by my manager, and I'd gotten a good review that year, and was told that I was getting a 1% raise. And I questioned this, and the response was, quote unquote, it doesn't mean anything, and there are some people who are being paid, you know, half your salary. Well, I'm sure they weren't, you know, they didn't have my experience. I mean, at that time, I'd been at the paper for nearly 30 years.
And Bettina, really quick, because it's one thing to feel these things. Obviously, it sounds like things weren't subtle in your case. It seems like it was pretty obvious to you, but to know what other people are feeling, when did you realize that others shared your experiences and shared your feelings?
It was really when the newsroom approved a union in January of 2018, and the union then had legal access to pay data and conducted a pay study. So in April of 2018, a pay study came out, and it showed tremendous disparities between what men and women were being paid and also between what white employees and non-white employees were being paid. So that was really the first time that everybody could see the disparities that they had long suspected. And there was quite a bit of anger in the newsroom. And in some cases, it was really devastating for some women. I mean, I know one person who wound up being one of the co-plaintiffs recalled that when she saw the results of the pay study, she cried when she saw, you know, how low she was in ranking. It was insulting and demeaning. And that was really the first time that everybody could see. It was just right there in vivid numbers what the disparity was.
And that's like a Band-Aid being ripped off kind of moment. Meg, as media reporter covering your own paper, put this case into context for us. What else was happening in the media landscape as this all evolved?
Well, this was a very dynamic time at the LA Times. In the middle of 2017, we had a big shakeup where longstanding editors were forced out. We had a revolving door of top editors. The ownership of the paper changed in early 18. The paper was rescued by one of our local billionaires, Patrick Soon-Shiong. His wife, Michelle, they came in and stepped in and bought the LA Times and the San Diego Union Tribune. And this case, which started actually about the same time that Dr. Soon-Shiong was taking charge of the paper, really, I think in many ways signified a lot of the past alleged abuses that had gone on. For many years, the LA Times was like an unwanted stepchild of Tribune. The Chicago ownership really bristled at some of the demands that the LA Times was making as the largest paper in the chain. And so it was a very turbulent time. And I think that the pay study that Bettina just referenced, you know, showed a lot of people that, yes, while we were having problems in the newsroom, just, you know, with this management turmoil, a lot of the problems were very systemic.
Bettina, why did you decide to go the legal route on this?
So to get back to the pay study, that was about the same time, you know, after it came out, soon thereafter, I started to, you know, look into a legal action because you could see how deeply entrenched these disparities were. And this was before Dr. Soon-Shiong actually closed on the paper, but everybody knew that he was buying it. And so the response of management, you know, after the pay study came out and women and people of color began to ask for raises was, well, we can't do anything. You know, we haven't been sold yet. And then after we were sold, it was, well, we have to see what, because the union was in contract negotiations for its first ever contract. And then it was, well, no, we're not going to be giving out any raises while the contract is being negotiated. You have to wait until the contract is approved.
So kicking the can down the road is what
right,
was happening.
Kicking the can down the road. And again, I mean, it was just so obvious to me that this was deeply entrenched. And, you know, I started talking to a number of people, and you could just see, you could hear the same story over and over and over again of them asking for raises or being given, you know, when they were hired, lowball offers, how deeply ingrained it was. So it was pretty obvious that just trying to address this on an individual basis wasn't going to work. I mean, the paper was, you know, more than 130 years old. And this had been going on for a long time.
Not only that, when we're talking about this time period, it was a time where the paper was losing a tremendous amount of ad revenue. And I think, you know, without making excuses for the management, they were looking at a situation where our revenue was going down. And they probably saw, like, oh my gosh, we have this dramatic fall in print advertising. And at the same time that they should have been looking at equities in the newsroom, they might have not been giving the equities in the newsroom the attention it deserved.
We're speaking with Bettina Boxall, staff writer for the LA Times, lead plaintiff on the case, and also Meg James, corporate media reporter for the LA Times. Meg, over the years, what changes have you seen in the newsroom culture as the LA Times has tried to distance itself from its previous ownership?
Well, this year has been a very important and probably transformational year. With the George Floyd protests that we saw in June, there was really a mini uprising within the LA Times internally, with people bringing to the fore issues that had been long standing, issues about how, you know, different reporters were being treated and over-reliance on younger and largely minority reporters, you know, to fill the pages while, you know, some of the more glamorous spots went to older white people. So I think that the paper has really looked at this year, they've been forced to look at, and they have looked at its own treatment of its staff, as well as how we represent people of color in our news pages. I think what you saw just in the last few months was we had a series of stories in which we published the personal stories of black reporters, of Hispanics, and just talking about, you know, how they've seen the paper over time. Our owner, Patrick Soon-Shiong, wrote a remarkable apology for how, you know, that in the past, the paper neglected issues that were very important to the community. We looked at situations in the 1980s news stories that really cast South LA in a bad light. And I think that the paper is trying with, you know, Dr. Soon-Shiong, his wife, Michelle, and even his daughter, Nika, to address these longstanding issues. And I think this settlement, you know, is one of the things that the paper wants to put its past behind us. And really, you know, be more inclusive and, you know, more fair in how we treat not only the people that work at the Times, but also the community.
But Tina, thinking about these larger issues of racial and gender discrimination in newsrooms, I'm wondering how you think these problems may have seeped into the actual journalism at the paper, if at all. Because, I mean, if the discrimination was systemic, I mean, did it affect what issues got covered and how they were covered?
What gets covered and how it gets covered is somewhat subjective. And so the lens through which assignments and editing and writing is filtered makes a difference. And if that lens is implicitly, unconsciously, or deliberately biased one way or the other, you know, it does show up. Story suggestions being taken less seriously, you know, in terms of covering different communities or how approaches should be made. So, yes, of course this has made a difference in what the LA Times has covered over the years and how it's covered it. When, you know, you make sure that all voices are being heard and all voices are being taken seriously and that story ideas are being taken seriously and not just brushed aside because, oh, no, we really don't care about that issue or really don't care about that subject, then you begin to really cover the full richness. I mean, L.A. is an incredible place to cover. The more attuned we are to the community, the better our coverage will be and the richer everyone will be. If you want to cover L.A., you have to cover diversity because that is what Los Angeles is.
But Tina, wondering what your reaction is about the outcome now that the case has been settled and also how we all move forward from this and maybe also just at the LA Times too.
When two companies agree to a $3 million settlement, I mean, that very much gets their attention. So I think this is, you know, and I'm pretty sure this is probably the first settlement of its kind in the entire history of the LA Times. So that very much gets management attention and puts them on notice that they can't continue this. So I think it is significant in that regard. I mean, certainly $3 million is not going to make up for all the lost wages over the years and the decades that women and people in color have experienced. But I do think that it will help make sure that this does not continue in the future. And in terms of what newsrooms can learn, I think it's not so much what papers can learn. Well, papers can learn that, you know, they are going to be held liable for this. And newsrooms, you know, can see that you don't just sit back and take it and just assume that, okay, that's the way it is and the newspaper industry is in bad shape and we really can't do anything about it. You can do something about it. Find out what the pay scale is. Take action. Push back. Because it's time that these inequities end.
And pushing back is what journalism's all about. That's Bettina Boxall, staff writer for the LA Times, lead plaintiff on the case. Meg James, also corporate media reporter for the LA Times. Bettina, Meg, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, A.
I got my first job when I was 17. It wasn't to buy clothes or buy a car. It was so I can go see as many movies as I wanted without having to ask my parents for money to buy a movie ticket. And since then, I really haven't gone more than a couple of weeks without going to the movies until 8 months ago. That's when COVID shut it all down. But now, light at the end of the tunnel. That's coming up next on Take Two. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. The possibility of a COVID vaccine would not just be a lifesaver for humans all over the world. It would also be a financial savior for movie theater chains that are holding on to the edge of an economic cliff by their fingertips. Also, a Hollywood studio is paying a big star his full salary not to shoot a film. Time for On the Lot.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Rebecca Keegan is senior editor film for The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, we have talked about this for months. Pre-pandemic, I'm a lock to see one or two movies every single weekend. But once the reality of everything set in, I accepted that I'm probably not going to be stepping into a movie theater until a vaccine is everywhere. Now, Rebecca, I know it's still very early, but what does Pfizer's announcement this week mean for movie theater chains?
Well, you are in good company in how you feel about going to theaters before there's a vaccine. About 30% of consumers have said they won't go back to theaters until there's a vaccine. So the Pfizer news this week, which I think most people are greeting with cautious optimism, was good news for movie theater companies. Their stocks soared. Shares of AMC, IMAX, and Cinemark were all up this week on the news, which really gives theaters something they've been lacking, and that is kind of a timeline for the potential end of this pandemic. They've been just sort of pulling through, dealing month to month with changes to movie release schedules, openings, closures, and this kind of shows them some light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, hope is rearing its beautiful head for the movie business, at least. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've seen how release dates for big budget tentpole type films have been futzed with in 2020. They've been pushed back in other cases. What does the possibility of vaccine do for the 2021 schedule?
Well, 2021 was already packed because of all of the big movies that have been pushed from 2020. So really the only big movie remaining in 2020 is Wonder Woman, which is supposed to come out in Christmas. And I'll be surprised if that date sticks given the new recent numbers on the pandemic and the likelihood that New York and LA theaters may have to stay closed. 2021, meanwhile, could have Wonder Woman if that movie pushes, as well as a bunch of other stuff that's already moved, like the James Bond film for MGM, Marvel's Black Widow movie, Universal's Fast and Furious sequel, Quiet Place sequel, In the Heights, Venom. Now, these are all movies that were supposed to come out in 2020 and are instead going to kick off in 2021 with, fingers crossed, a vaccine.
Oh, Wonder Woman Bond double feature. Same one price. How about, I'm already making their profits for them, although it's a deal for me. Rebecca, generally, how have movie theaters, though, been holding up in 2020?
Not great. About 50% of theaters in the U.S. are open, and most of them are operating at 25 to 50% capacity. And they don't have big studio movies, the kind that really draw moviegoers to them. So they've been using little films to get by. National Association of Theater Owners is asking Congress for relief, saying that 96% of theaters have seen losses of greater than 70%.
Any signs that Hollywood is ramping up production, at least?
Well, yeah, people are getting back to work in the production business. Film LA reports this week that film permit applications are up over the last 2 months. Production resumed in June, and since then there have been about 2,500 applications. Still way under what it would be in pre-pandemic times, about 47% of usual time. But, you know, people are starting to get back to work.
Sounds like something is better than nothing. What kind of productions are up and running?
Most of it's commercials, about 44% is people shooting ads for Instagram, Uber, Subaru, Starbucks. Next, about 25% is TV production, so shows like NCIS LA, Shameless, Dear White People, American Idol, Shaws of Sunset, to name a few.
Didn't hear any movies on your list, Rebecca.
Yeah, that's only 4% of the permit applications are for films. That includes Paul Thomas Anderson's 1970s movie Soggy Bottom, King Richard, which is the Warner Brothers movie starring Will Smith as the father of Venus and Serena Williams, and Channing Tatum's directorial debut, which is called Dog. But very few movies, partly because the movies, as we said, the studios have been holding on to them. They haven't been able to release them, as opposed to TV shows, which have had to air and now need to sort of restock the coffers.
So why take a chance if you don't know when you can put it out, I guess? Yeah.
Exactly. Talking
to Rebecca Keegan, senior editor film for The Hollywood Reporter. All right, now to a movie that is in production in London, but without one of the biggest names in Hollywood. Rebecca, tell us what's going on with the third film in the Fantastic Beasts series.
Well, Johnny Depp, who had shot just one scene, is now out of the series. Warner Brothers made the decision to replace Depp, who plays dark wizard Gellert Grindelwald, last week. This came after a UK judge dismissed Depp's defamation suit against the Sun tabloid for the headline, quote, "How can J.K. Rowling be genuinely happy casting wife-beater Johnny Depp in the new Fantastic Beasts film?" Johnny Depp already posed a number of PR challenges for Warner Brothers due to the allegations of domestic violence in his marriage to Amber Heard. This judge's decision makes it likely that those PR headaches are not going to go away anytime soon. Depp is also suing Heard in Virginia, which would have interrupted the shooting schedule, one that's already been sort of messed with thanks to COVID.
Now, if I only did one segment of Take Two, I think KPCC would not be happy. They might not want to pay me for a full Take Two. So why does Depp get to shoot only one scene and still Warner Brothers has to pay the full salary?
Right. Well, so Johnny Depp, Eddie Redmayne, and Jude Law are the stars of this film, and they share equal screen time. But Depp's salary, which is an eight-figure salary, is the biggest. And he has what's called a pay-or-play contract, which means he gets that money whether the movie's finished or not, whether he's recast. He also agreed to resign. He was not fired. And this is a big, lucrative franchise for Warner Brothers. It's earned $1.4 billion. So they are eager to sort of make this problem go away for the cost of Depp's salary.
One more thing on this, Rebecca. Who's going to jump in for Depp?
Danish actor Mads Mikkelsen, who's probably best known for the TV show Hannibal, but also appeared in Rogue One, and Doctor Strange will be taking over the role. Well, right. At least is in talks.
In talks, okay. Now, speaking of terrifying roles to play, the headline of a story in The Hollywood Reporter is this: a predator is impersonating an Oscar-winning filmmaker. He's the perfect con man. Rebecca, tell us what's happening with British filmmaker Hugh Welchman.
Yeah, so Welchman he won an Oscar for producing a short film, Peter and the Wolf, and he co-directed the 2017 film Loving Vincent. He started to get angry Instagram messages from a woman he didn't know. She described him as a predator, and when he would post about his wife, she would write, if only she knew what Welchman had done to her on Skype. His manager also got a call alerting him that someone was claiming to be Welchman, but dismissed it. So all very strange. This turned out to be a person impersonating Welchman. About 13 people have come forward in LA, New York, and Texas saying that a man pretending to be Welchman had contacted them with promises of a movie role and then sort of transferred those conversations into some uncomfortable ones in which women were encouraged to expose themselves on video.
Now, with all due respect to Hugh Welchman, why Hugh Welchman?
Exactly. Most of us are probably hearing his name for the first time. He's not a well-known filmmaker, and that may have been part of the appeal for this imposter. The person could just sort of ad-lib a backstory, and no one would really know any different. But Welchman is significant enough in a business that he has, you know, an IMDb profile and some known credits. The imposter did make some mistakes, however. For instance, he claimed that Welchman was from India and that his first language was Sanskrit, which has not, outside of yoga studios, been a living language in about 1,000 years. So, exposed himself a little bit in that regard.
That's bold. That's bold, to say that you know a language that hasn't been used in 1,000 years.
Yeah, bold is one word for it, and dumb is another. But this person has not been caught yet. The LAPD is investigating and believes that the person is based in the United States.
All right. Rebecca Keegan is senior editor of film for The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, I think it's fair to say that you never, ever forget your first podcast that you've ever listened to. I'll never forget it because I wanted to listen to something on a 9-hour drive to Salt Lake City, Utah. I was visiting my daughter. She had her first child. It was my first grandson. So I wanted to listen to something that would last the entire route up the 15 all the way to Salt Lake City. And it was a true crime podcast. And I got hooked. I got hooked. True crime is one of the most popular kinds of podcasts. We'll find out why when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. True crime has been a staple, maybe even the catnip genre of podcasts that have gotten many people hooked who were not early listeners to pods. This week, Nick Kwa, the host of the LAS Studios podcast Servant of Pod, talks with a creative guy who took his expertise telling true crime stories on screen to the podcast space. Mark Smerling is co-creator of the podcast Crime Town. His film and TV credits include the HBO documentary series The Jinx and the Oscar-nominated documentary film Capturing the Freedmans. All right, Nick, can you tell us a little bit more about Mark Smerling and why you decided to interview him for your podcast?
Yeah, so Mark is considered in some circles as like a true crime pioneer. He's worked on a bunch of these projects, on a bunch of them you just mentioned, which created a bunch of buzz when they came out. And in particular, I think the most popular and prominent of these projects was The Jinx, which kind of looked at this the travails and the mystery around this real estate mogul named Robert Durst. And that documentary, it dug up enough information to sort of reopen the trial and had a sort of an iconic piece of tape capture at the end. I think a bunch of folks who are into true crime stuff probably is well aware of that show. And they probably are well aware of Mark. And so I wanted to talk to him, well, in part because he has these new projects out. He's got this documentary series with FX called Wilderness of Error, which is kind of a return to a very famous case in the 50s and in the 60s, which is, it's kind of your classic true crime case. Did this guy kill his family or not? And many books have been written about it. He's made this new documentary series returning to this subject. And that's kind of the hook of why I wanted to talk to him. But the thematic reason is that Mark has left a really big mark on true crime podcasting with the one project he did back in 2015 called Crime Town, which, it was really popular, and it really sort of reshaped the way a lot of people thought about what true crime could be done within podcasting.
Is there a particular aesthetic to his approach to storytelling? Because I'm just going off of The Jinx. That thing had me on the edge of my seat, man.
He's very interested in process. He's very interested in sort of the ornate like biographies and an ornate like background. I think that's part of the sort of through line of his works. But I don't know, like Crime Town feels really different from The Jinx. It's like sprawling. It's an epic. Mm. It's full of these sort of shady, like wise guys running around Providence, Rhode Island. And I feel like that kind of texture is what he really likes.
All right, so he works mostly in the genre of true crime. What is it about the genre that's appealing and different from other genres?
So that's one of the big questions I wanted to grapple with when I spoke to him, because I don't know. I mean, I think I might be in a minority of this. Like, I'm not the biggest fan of true crime.
What?
maybe I think it's more appropriate that, like, I'm more of a snob when it comes to true crime. Like,
you
I like
just
stuff
reached
that's...
into my heart and took it out and looked at it and threw it on the ground, Nikwa.
I'm sorry, man. I'm just saying, like, you know, people dying, that kind of stuff really bugs me. And, you know, commodification of all that. Anyway, so I put the question to Mark, like, what is the deal with true crime? Why is it so popular? And he brought up this idea that his production partner, Zach Stewart Pontier, brought up over the course of a bunch of projects. And here's what he said.
Well, I think Zach Pontier put it, one part of it, very well. He said that true crime is the magnification of true life in a very dramatic way. It's everything that we think about that we don't understand, and it's to the nth degree. So we're looking to find some sort of explanation. Why? Why did this guy, why would he do this? Hmm. You know, we need to know. The world needs to make sense to people. Unfortunately, the world doesn't make sense. You know, it just doesn't. And people are even more nonsensical.
Yeah, so his big thing, I think the big like emotional idea there is just like the relentless unpredictability and unfairness of the universe gets captured a lot in stories of true crime.
Well, that's exactly true, because here's the thing. When we're talking about a crime, and sometimes it's something really horrible, it doesn't make sense, right, that something like that could ever happen in a world. But then when I listen to these things, I want it to make sense to me. In other words, to find some reason how this is possible. I think that's where the appeal is for a lot of people, even though for Nikwa, it doesn't seem to stick with Nikwa.
I am very comfortable with the unpredictability of the universe.
All right. So how is he able to tell then a compelling true crime story in each medium? What are those particular components?
So his big building block, and I think this is true for a lot of people working in true crime and a lot of people working in documentary in general, it really comes down to the raw material. So raw tape, archival footage, the stuff that you don't need a narrator to sort of bring you into, you just need the raw stuff, like the representation of real life. And he talks a little bit about that importance of tape and why he finds himself drawn to podcasting because of this capacity around tape. He talks about that in this clip.
Well, the real reason I love doing podcasts is because of found audio. You know, I'm always looking for it. So there's some trials that are recorded in video, and there's some things that you can get in video, but there's almost always audio. When we made The Jinx, you know, we were able to find audio tapes that were kept by the transcriber of the Galveston trial in the bottom of a file box that was in his garage. All of a sudden, we had these audio tapes, and you could be in that space.
All right, Nick, before we let you go, for any listeners that are now very eager to listen to a more true crime podcast, do you have any recommendations, maybe from classics to newer editions?
You know, I'll stick to the classics, partly because of my, let's call it a high bar for true crime. The first pick is Criminal. It's a really great sort of anthology show full of unexpected stories that take like almost like an anthropological approach to true crime stories. It's great. The second pick, so New Hampshire Public Radio did a fantastic series a while back called Bear Brook. Again, it's about a case in New Hampshire, but in many ways, that series is a deconstruction of the genre. And finally, a quick shout out for the second season of In the Dark, which had a really big development recently. The case that they examined in that season, sort of their reporting led to this person being freed from prison, which is remarkable, which is kind of what you want from a project like this. So those are my two picks.
Nick, I will never forget the first podcast that I listened to all the way through. I had a long 9-hour drive to Utah to visit my daughter. You know, she just had her first child, my first grandkid, and I listened to the Silk Road. It just seemed to draw me in. 9 hours went by like that, Nick, because I was so drawn in. Luckily, I was paying attention to the road. Nothing bad happened to me on the road, but that, I mean, it sucked me in.
Well, I mean, that's kind of what you want from that experience, right? Like, you have this central mystery, and you kind of don't want to leave it until you figure out the truth, or you realize that you'll never figure out the truth. And so, I don't know. That's kind of what you want from these experiences.
That's Nick Kwa. He's the host of the LA Studios podcast about podcasts, Servant of Pod. You can find it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, so I've got a workout plan for you. If you're planning on, say, taking a walk, let's say about 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, and you want to go, like, say, a 45, 50-minute walk, this is what you do. You get on your phone, you get the KPCC app, you download Take 2. We're about a 45 to 50-minute walk. You listen to us, you finish the show, and your walk finishes. You feel good because you've exercised and you listen to Take 2. Do that. Watch. It'll do wonders for your health. More Take 2 tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.